You're in the water loop.
Welcome to Waterloop, the podcast that explores solutions for sustainability and equity in water. I'm the host, Travis Loop. This episode is part of a series, Mississippi by Nature, that looks at the use of nature-based solutions to help the river and its communities. The series is supported by the Walton Family Foundation and outfitted by Patagonia. This episode features a ride to the mouth of the Mississippi River with Captain Richie Blink of Delta Discovery Tours, who shares how he has seen the river change and how using nature itself is beneficial. Then I speak with John Sabo, director of the Bywater Institute at Tulane University, about the health of the Mississippi and the role of nature-based solutions.
You're in the water loop.
I'm here at the mouth of the Mississippi, one of the mightiest rivers in the world.
The trip to where the Mississippi River meets the Gulf of Mexico came courtesy of Captain Richie Blink, who has spent his life on the bayous of Louisiana studying its wetlands, people, and economy.
So Richie, this spot here, I just noticed kind of convergence of some different waterways, some different currents. What is this spot?
So we're at the Venice Jump. And so we're at the intersection of the Mississippi and the Venice Jump. And what was going on here, sometime during the 19th century, there was a small wooden lock here that failed. And once that lock failed, the Mississippi River short-circuited through here, and about 120,000 acres were built over a century's time. You know, that showcases like the power of the river here, right? The river can solve a lot of our problems if we just let it or gently guide it.
Yeah.
And this isn't the only place where this has happened. It's happened just across the river here at Baptiste Colette. It's happened down at Main Pass. It's happened at Garden Island Bay. And now today it's happening at Neptune Pass. We tend to over-engineer things sometimes, and the world isn't sterile like that, right? Where things just aren't unfolding like on a sheet of paper in a fluorescently lit office building over the horizon, right? And so if we marry these ideas of using nature and human-based solutions like rock revetments and trees behind them, plant five different species of trees in case a weevil or some other sort of sickness comes through, we could engineer a more predictable shipping channel and watershed, right? I mean, this is the fourth largest watershed on the planet. And we've been managing it almost strictly for like certainty of commerce for, 300 years here in Louisiana. And it's time that we have to start thinking about, how do we manage this for, all the critters that help support us and how to blunt some of the impacts of climate change and those types of things. So we're here in the main shipping channel, just south of Venice, really close to the mouth of the Mississippi. And behind us is a chemical tanker headed upstream to New Orleans. It's coming out of Houston today. But there's about 45 ship crossings daily here. And in comparison, the Panama Canal is about 35 daily. And what's going on is there's about $250 million that's spent dredging the lower river here to allow for passage of these ships. And that's sort of like 1880s way of managing the river. It's almost like long overdue that we need to really reevaluate how do we do this? And we're at this spot right here where the river is about 3/4 of a mile wide. Now, the shipping channel is just from where the boat's sitting currently to the bank over here. And that might be about 1/3 of the total river width here. And so what's happening is the current's spreading out, sediment's slowing down, and there's so much dredging that's having to happen, which is expensive, it belches a lot of carbon out. And if we just simply manage the river in a different way, like created a big island where the shallow spot is, that would force the current into this shallow spot. We could have a smaller boat lane on the other side so that we could separate the smaller traffic from the bigger traffic. Everybody would be safer. It would be much less expensive. And it would just be a simple just managing what we're already doing in a slightly different way for a better result. So over on the bank here are some bald cypress trees. And this was from the first tree planting I'd organized back in 2010. We planted about 1,400 trees in a morning, and it was a really great victory, and I'm glad we were able to do that. The local river pilots were able to bring us downriver, and like the 4-H kids from the local school were out here planting the trees. The state gave us like surplus trees from their ag and forestry department. And we planted these to help knock down storm surge, to hold the bank together, to just increase the usefulness of the ecosystem for all the critters here. And it worked out well. You can see some of these are 25, 30 feet high now. So the bank line has stopped receding where the tree line is here, right? So we were able to arrest erosion here just the erosion of the coast from shipwrecks and things like that by using just like native vegetation.
Advancing science is essential for the use of nature-based solutions for the Mississippi River. I'm here at Tulane's River and Coastal Center to talk to its director, John Sabo, about the work they're doing to advance science, to understand nature-based solutions, and to help the Mississippi River. John, I'm excited to be here to talk to you about the Mississippi River. I want to talk first some table setting foundational stuff, if you will. The Mississippi River, why is it so important? Why is it so iconic?
The Mississippi River touches pieces of 31 or 32 states in the US and a couple of provinces in Canada. Mm. It is America's heartland, right? And in that heartland, we grow corn, we grow soy, we grow wheat, we grow rice. In that heartland, especially down here, we produce oil. And we have a shipping infrastructure that distributes those commodities upriver and downriver, and the river is essential for that. From the standpoint of a modern economy, it's kind of like the cardiovascular system of the United States in some ways, right?
Yeah.
And then it has huge cultural significance too. I mean, you know, all the books we've read about the Mississippi, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn,
right?
And so that, you know, both of those things I think are really important and really kind of underscore the importance of the river.
Yeah. How has the river been altered, both physically from a hydrologic standpoint, ways that impact water quantity, ways that impact water quality, flooding. It's really struck me the human impacts on the river. I'd love to hear you talk about that.
There are many.
it's a long story, right?
Yeah. Stop me if I go on too long.
No.
I mean, I actually just taught a class at Tulane called Climate Change and Global Rivers, and there was a Mississippi River section. And one of the things that I'm learning is that the Mississippi is a whole different kind of animal than the Colorado, right? When you ask about water supply, that is the Colorado, right? It's manipulated and engineered for that, and that purpose pretty much only. Mm. The Mississippi is different. There is a part of it that emanates from the west, which is managed like the Colorado. But that's not the biggest water supply for the Mississippi, right? If you think about the Mississippi as a river system, it's got three branches. It's got the Missouri, which comes from the west and is like the west in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's got the main stem Mississippi, which comes from Lake Itasca in Minnesota, and it's got the Ohio, Tennessee. And in terms of water supply, Ohio, Tennessee is number one, middle is number two, and Missouri is number three. Huh. So it's, you know, that gives you some context about where the water's coming from.
Yeah.
Then there's sediment. Sediment's the opposite. Most of it comes from Missouri. And then, thereafter, probably Ohio, Tennessee, and the main stem. So the way that it's been managed is going back to your first question about why is it so important. It's been managed for transportation, mainly for getting commodities out of the river and getting products from the global markets into the basin to ports further upstream. You know, it's engineered that way all the way to Chicago, right? Minneapolis, St. Louis, there's even a part of it. Yeah, so that it's managed for shipping. And the big impact is that there's a levee from New Orleans all the way to Minneapolis.
We have to pause, right, for that, in my mind. A levee, it's levied that entire distance.
Yeah.
And that's incredible because that's, I don't know, over 1,500 miles or something like that.
Yeah.
Where this river has been walled off and held in that course.
Yeah.
And you experienced that during a recent road trip. Could you talk about what that was like?
Yeah, I took this road trip with my daughter Lily. 6 days we blazed from New Orleans to Lake Itasca, maybe seven. And the whole goal was to find the river and to ask people about the river and what their relationship was with the river. And what we learned is that it actually is pretty hard to find the river. Mm. You have to work at it to get to see it in most places, except for on bridges in cities. right? Those are points where you can see the river because it goes over the levee there. Hmm. So I think that, you know, it sounds like such a trivial observation, but it's so profound, right? If a river as big as the Mississippi, if people say, I don't have a relationship with the river, right?
Yeah. I can't access it. I don't see it on a regular basis.
It doesn't touch me. And I think, you know, going back to your question about the impacts, like the goals were twofold for levying the system. One was to stabilize the shipping of commodities and whatnot. And the other was flood control, right? And that perhaps was a second effort on the part of the Army Corps of Engineers starting in 1900s, 1927, after that flood. So, you know, that's got dual purpose there. And, you know, if we are going to change the way it works, we have to think about both of those purposes and how they would work in a system that's different.
One of the interesting things I've learned is how, you know, the river, even down here towards New Orleans or southern Louisiana, like it really wants to shift course and wants to go other ways. And the Atchafalaya is where it has wanted to jump and go. Mm-hmm. But that's even been cut off, right? Or controlled, if you will.
It's been cut off, but we still manage it at Natchez to send water to keep that alive, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, like if you look at maps of coastal erosion and places where we're gaining more coastline in the Atchafalaya than we are near the mouth of the Mississippi. Mm. So, that part's interesting, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think historically the river wandered, right? But now we need it in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And Baton Rouge, and so we have that system.
So that's kind of the hardening of the river, impacting its flow and its course and so forth. What about the water quality piece? You talked about all the agriculture that's in the upper part of the Mississippi. Could you explain what that looks like and what that's done to the water?
Second most profound observation, which also sounds trivial, but it's super profound, is that there was corn everywhere. Like, we did not drive in a mile where we didn't see a cornfield from here to Minnesota. So imagine that scale of production, right, with fertilizers and pesticides and things farmers need to make a yield with narrow margins. That stuff ends up in the river. I mean, you and I talked about tile drains before.
Yeah.
You know, that sends that stuff to the river faster, right? So if you think about that production system, it's enormous, and all of those nutrients are getting concentrated in the river channel and sent down to here in New Orleans and on the coast and in the Gulf, and they create an anoxic zone in the Gulf that's hazardous to fisheries, for example. Yeah. It creates other environmental problems that we experience here because of production across the entire river, including in our own state.
Yeah. Could you talk about that a little bit further? Explain what a dead zone is for people that might not be as familiar or have the water knowledge.
Sure. So, a dead zone is the result of eutrophication, which is too much nutrients, right? Mm-hmm. Too much fertilizer, too many nutrients in the water, and those nutrients happen to enter the Gulf through the Mississippi from this production system upstream, right? Those nutrients stimulate growth of phytoplankton. That phytoplankton has a short lifespan. It's turning over, and dying and sinking to the bottom, where it gets digested by microbes. Those microbes need oxygen to do that, and they eat up all the oxygen in decomposing those phytoplankton near the bottom. And so that creates a dead zone that grows up in the water column and takes over habitats for shellfish, for finfish, things like that.
All right, well, let's shift toward the positive a little bit. I really want to talk to you about the concept of nature-based solutions. When you hear that phrase, what does that mean to you?
I mean, I've heard NBS, we call it, framed in so many different ways, mm-hmm. right? Natural infrastructure, green infrastructure, engineering with nature. In short, it's a tool for climate adaptation. Right, and that's the way I think about it. It's something we can build on the side of built infrastructure to improve our climate adaptation, not only directly, but by supporting the function of built infrastructure as well. So, second point is, I like to say that they're not competing against each other. Mm. We need them both. And we need to think about how to reconnect the natural piece of that infrastructure to the function of built infrastructure in order to have climate adaptation. Mm.
And for the Mississippi, what about the role of nature-based solutions in the Mississippi? Is this it's imperative to get more of these going? Do you hear about more nature-based solutions, kind of projects happening? How would you kind of connect that to the Mississippi?
Well, here in Louisiana, the CPRA is undertaking some of the biggest natural infrastructure experiments on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so we're already doing that in this state for climate adaptation, right? So we're building coastlines back, river floodplains back. You're going to be down in Plaquemines Parish, which is on the way to the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, which is the biggest project we've ever done in the United States in terms of natural infrastructure, reconnecting floodplains to grow back coastal wetlands, right? But the basin's big, so there are other options in the toolkit. We talked about Colorado and the western U.S. Fires are a huge problem there, mm. right? And so forest protection and figuring out which forests we can save and which ones we can't and making the transition on the ones we can't is a big intervention that we have to start thinking about. And that's important for the Mississippi. On farms, you're going to see the corn as you work your way up the river. There's lots of things we can do on farms that are nature-based. Mm. And hopefully you'll get to talk to some people who do things like prairie strips, recharge of aquifers using on-farm holding ponds, recapturing irrigation water or rainwater from the tile drain process like we talked about. These are all nature-based solutions, right, that are important for sustainability of farming in a basin that's going to change a lot.
Yeah, I like that point, right? This isn't just for the water quality or water supply or hydrology or nature. A lot of these steps are necessary for commerce, not just navigation, but farms themselves, right? Yeah. Like to help with their long-term sustainability. As you were talking about what's happening down here in coastal Louisiana, it's amazing to think of like rebuilding nature, just right, barrier islands and wetlands, yeah. and letting the river flow and deposit sediment. I mean, major scale projects that are happening here.
Well, and that's it's the third thing I thought of when you asked me this question is scale. We're here in Louisiana, we are approaching the problem with the right scale. Right, Mid-Barataria is enormous, and it's a gamble. Mm. But we need to be taking those gambles in order to make a difference in the future. And so think about that at the scale of the watershed. Think about how many farms we would need to do prairie strips on in order to change the dead zone. It's a lot. We don't know what that number is. We want to work on that as a research question, as an aside. But think about that scale. It's big, right? Because the production system is enormous. So, but the key point, I think, is that we're engineering with purpose, right? We're building nature that we need and letting nature decide if that's okay or not, but not trying to restore some nostalgic vision of what nature was 200 years ago, because we're not there. We have climate change. We have burgeoning commodities-based economy, and we can't do that. So we've got to do it differently.
That's the end of the first day of this epic journey from the mouth of the Mississippi to the source to learn about nature-based solutions. Spent the day with a boat captain going to that mouth of the Mississippi and with a professor on the edge of the river in New Orleans. And they both confirmed to me this need for nature-based solutions to get away from the big hard infrastructure and to start to use the way nature works to help the river and its communities. Really a great way to kick off this trip. I'm excited to go next to talk to the Army Corps of Engineers about engineering with nature.
Please stay tuned for more of the series, Mississippi by Nature, supported by the Walton Family Foundation and outfitted by Patagonia. To find all episodes, sign up for email updates, and connect on social media, visit waterloop.com. waterloop.org.
You're in the water loop. Waterloop.